Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
When you look at managed services or, you know, out-of-house versus in-house, it also, I think, depends on how many tools you have, because it's not just about managing, so like an endpoint tool, but you could have a SIM. I mean, there's several other things that some of these MDR providers or other people provide or have created their own platforms and solutions to integrate everything together. And I think it also comes down, like, people say, well, it depends how many people you have, A, on your team, or if you have a SOC, if you don't have a SOC. I also think it just comes down to expertise, you know, like really understanding the product sets that you're using. Because I think before we had the conversation around training and why training is important. Absolutely. I mean, if you buy this, it's like the same thing if you go out and buy this really expensive sports car with a stick, but you've never driven a stick before, right? Unless somebody sits down and takes you out for a ride and you really get the feel, the clutch and everything else, it's the same thing with your security tool. If you've never used it and now you have, you know, going from a traditional AV to, let's say, an EDR solution, and now you have all this telemetry data and all this other stuff, you have things that you can query, but you don't know how to do it. Really, how good is that tool then for you? You
know, and there is such a thing as being too advanced for the organization and actually making it harder to detect when things are going on, if your organization isn't mature enough to be able to handle the type of the type and flow level of information coming out of it. So, you know, that's a place where looking at outside services is a really opportune thing.
It's true. And it's interesting when you think about it. If you think about the evolution of the tools, Brian, you mentioned the EDR tool, right? That's kind of a more recent development that's come into existence for us. And
hey, Eric, before you go into it, what is EDR?
So endpoint detection and response. So I think we all have different definitions of it, but essentially the next evolution of antivirus, right? Where now we're getting better telemetry data. It's not based on signatures anymore. It's based on heuristics, activity, indicators of attack, things of that. So the next generation of what we once were in a signature-based world. But if you think about the evolution of those tools, I think those really curtailed changed the dynamic of the conversation and internal versus external, getting toward that hybrid model. Because as the tools become more advanced, then maybe I don't need those uber advanced people to read all of the minutia data, the just vast amount of alerts that we used to get in the security world, and have to be able to go through them and decide if they're legit or not.
Are we to the point where we can start to trust these tools to do this for us and rely more on automation than on people? And this is one of my concerns about either putting huge amounts of trust into a tool or into a third party. I guess it's an evolution of my long-term question about using third parties or MSSPs who aggregate a lot of things and are trying to service a lot of customers at the same time. And aren't necessarily doing it all with eyes on glass. They're waiting to see the red blinky light, and then they look at it, and then they call you. EDR seems to be doing the same thing, or sorry, not just EDR, more the advanced security tools that are coming out today are doing the same thing, where we're putting more confidence in the automation, or you have to put more confidence in the automation, and then you wait for the red blinky light, either at your service provider or on your internal SOC. And it feels like people are putting less on looking in proactive fashion for issues that have arisen. And this would be one of my reasons where, you know, more reliance on traditional in-house staff and in-house techniques might be a huge benefit.
But also, like, I'm going to pivot back to training. So when we talk about, when you said in-house, so you have in-house people, those people have to be trained on the product sets that you're using. You have turnover. how often are you retraining? Because this was something that we brought up just when we were sitting down having dinner, you know, several months ago, was how often do you have to retrain, and why is training important, or why do people leave, right? And in the case of security, I don't know that it's always that people are leaving, you know, a situation that they're not happy. There's such a big need, right? And there's larger entities coming in and they're gobbling them up and they're offering more money. And you spend this time training. We used to say the same thing when I was in the automotive side. Companies loved getting their hands on the people that we spent training for a year, because they were like, wow, you guys know so much about reading drawings and prints and being able to put together quotes. Like before, it's these guys just kind of came in and we gave it to them and then they just regurgitated. Like, it's like, yeah, wow, we really spent like a year or 2 years doing this. So you could have a very good training program. People do like their job and working for you. They're just offered a lot more to go somewhere else and they leave. And then you're retraining, right? And you have these tool sets and now you're retraining again. And as these tool sets change, and people that you hired maybe aren't used to those tool sets, they haven't used them before. It's not like when you go through the interview process, you're like, so here's the 30 tools or 5 tools that we use here. Have you used them before? No.
Have you read a modern job description? The expectation is that every candidate always have all those skills already, or they're just not fit to arrive. And for those listening, that's 100%, I guess, criticism of the way job descriptions are written. It shouldn't be that way.
Right. That actually, pivoting a little bit, looking at the job descriptions, this is actually fairly interesting. If you look at the amount of information disclosure that comes through of those, on a lot of those, I mean, we've all seen them, that it's people have their entire technology stack listed in some of those from an attacker point of view. Oh, that's awesome. I know you're using all these vendors. Yeah, I know how to beat, you know, pivot around. I know exactly what to expect in the environment. Interesting. The training thing is really interesting, right? Because it gets back to that leadership meme, I think, that came out a while ago on, you know, if we train them, they'll leave. But what happens if we don't train them and they stay, right? You have to train employees. There's no way around it. Now, I know there's probably a debate on paying for certificates and all of that stuff, but training is a must. I mean, if you look at the evolution of just the security field in general, it continues to get more and more advanced. It continues to change and pivot. And if you're not staying up with that, then I don't know if you could take a defensible stance as a company that you're doing the right things to protect customer employee data.
And I'll turn back on my own comment about in-house versus managed service, or using more of the automation. Is, you know, having built and staffed a internal SOC, it takes no less than 9 full-time people to do a 24/7 rotation, and that's nine people to, you know, to evenings and weekends and vacations. And that's a lot of training. It's a lot. It's trying to find 9 people. Now, I did this 16 years ago. Doing it now, trying to find 9 people that will come in on whatever salary you happen to be paying, and like Brian said, not disappear in a year. Or you have to build the program expecting that they'll disappear in a year. But it is really hard to do. And if every company did that themselves, if every organization did that themselves, then it would be, you know, we would need way more people than even the millions of shortfall we already are today. The other thing is you have to be an organization that's at least this tall in order to be able to even contemplate affording 9 people just to stare at screens and look at security incidents. If you look at small and medium businesses, this just doesn't exist. It cannot happen. And so you almost have to take the default position of, we need to leverage the technology. We need to leverage the automation as much as possible, because we just can't staff it. We might have 1 security person. Maybe it's a technologist that has a little bit of security expertise that's going to look at these things when the blinky light comes in. And then we go out to a third party, an outside IR firm or a CISO that's outside to help analyze and give us a little more contextual detail about it. But you know, the days of building SOCs for everybody, I think, are now limited to only the highest tier, largest, most risk averse organizations. So we have to rely on the tech.
So was that a 4 in-house or 4 out of house?
That I started out with the 4 in-house. That And then his last commentary was, in-house doesn't make sense for 95% of the constituency because it's just the company can't scale. It'd be out of scale with the rest of the organization.
And I actually have a colleague, and actually I'll say he's actually a good friend that is on a 24/7 SOC, and he does the nighttime shift, mm-hmm. and it's 4 days a week. And we always get together on Fridays, like every other week, for like our virtual social happy hour at like 4 o'clock. And
after running the SOC, you need some happy hour.
Well, that's like, he's waking up mid-afternoon and I'm like, man, that's gotta be tough. And he's like, you know, he's like, I'm very used to it, you know, like that schedule. And he goes, it does make the weekends a little bit harder, you know, just because of like the sleep schedule. And I got to get right back on that for the next week. And it's, he loves what he does, but again, you got to find X number of people. Like if you imagine if every organization had a 24/7 SOC, then you'd have to find that same person that exists in every area of the country.
And right? Then keep them.
And that's the big thing, right? I think we could all agree that it's, you know, depending on the study you look at, we've effectively got a negative unemployment rate in security, right? As technology grows, as companies evolve, you need security people behind it to help protect whatever it is that you're doing. And if somebody's willing to pay more, provide better benefits, it's very easy to poach security people away. And trying to create your own internal SOC is put you in a position whereby you're very likely in this market, you are constantly hiring. That you almost need a person that is just full-time hiring people in.
So now we're on to 10 people.
Right. It's interesting.
It's an amazing scale to have to keep up. And that doesn't count the people that have to do something about it when the blinky light goes off. You can put a lot into your SOC, into your Security Operations Center in the detect and do, but as soon as you shift them to more doing, they're no longer looking and detecting.
In coming from the vendor side though, it becomes a kind of a sticky situation depending on who you're talking with. Meaning you talk about the different range of customers, and I've dealt with several different range of customers, you know, small, I won't say too small because I'm obviously in the enterprise space, but there's obviously your smaller companies that maybe are under 2,000 employees, right? And then you have companies that are upwards of 50,000 or even larger than that. And how do you have the conversation around, so we also offer managed services, because most of the people I encounter in the security world don't like sales guys.
What?
I know. It was weird that you guys were like, hey, Brian, would you like to join us on this podcast? And I was like, oh, maybe they want a sales pitch. No, totally kidding.
You figured it out.
He's on to us.
It's all a sham. We see those. We love being pitched to.
Love the pitch.
But I can see, like, because nobody else can see the video right now, they can't see the smirks on your guys' faces, which I'm looking at right now. And I'm like, I just kind of want to mute my mic quick.
Just waiting to hear the best sales pickup line. What one works, right? It's like back to the dating scene.
But to the point of managed services, like I'm pretty, I would say transparent in the fact of when I'm in there having a conversation and I'm not trying to do a discovery of all the different tools you use, but if I hear that, well, I have this SIM and I'm looking at this, or I have this and I'm looking at this, and really what we need is, what do you guys offer in terms of managed services? I'm never going to manage the SIM and mine, you know, my tool or these other sets of tools. And there's a different conversation there, but at the same time, people would be like, well, why wouldn't you want to sell that? That's just adding more on. But at the end of the day, what's best for the customer? You know what I mean? Like if all you're going to get from me is the ability to manage my own endpoint tool, but really what you're looking for is the integration of this platform with this platform, or you're looking to pull, when we talk about EDR, endpoint detection and response, you're looking to pull that telemetry data, you know, funnel it out from a data lake and integrate it some other way, you know, to make it more useful. There's things that people can do. And I think when people hear the term managed services or MSSP, there's so many different types of offerings out there that is almost like its own little category of what are you looking for to manage? You know, is it just to manage my SOC, or am I looking to integrate several other tools? I'll let you guys take it from here.
There's a fundamental question there. You know, if you talk about MSS, MSSP and those things, as we traditionally knew those, do those stick around? Are they viable with today's technology stack? Do we need, because, you know, as I look at some of the big entrenched MSS, the managed security providers, or you know, choose your acronym there, out there, a lot of them are still set up to do a lot of firewall base, right? It's source, it's destination, it's port. Well, most of us, it's focusing on identity now. That's changed on the data we're looking at. And I, by and large, I don't think a lot of those security providers have really evolved with the tool set out there, and they become more a check the box. PCI says, I have to have this, therefore check, because this company is called X. And I begin to wonder with, you know, as we talk about EDR, MDR, that those become better fits for what we were originally trying to accomplish with an MSS, which is bring more technical resources to bear to augment the team that we have internally.
But I think it also requires, the other challenge is all those shifts that you mentioned require you to have a knowledge about the business itself. It's not just, this is why signature-based detection is gone, because you can't use just the if this, then that. You have to have context. You have to understand that. And some of the scope and approach of the outside services companies that do this aggregate work is, it doesn't scale if they have to take the time to be able to understand, or it's impossible for them to understand each one of their customers to the level that is required to truly understand it in the identity based, in the network, in the non-internal network mindset. You know, we have, that users are floating everywhere, that we've exposed our systems to the raw internet and are hardened and protecting them. Combinations of geolocation, some of the nuance of, we know this professor goes from here to here. We know that this salesperson is on the road in these countries, but he showed up over here. Some of those kind of nuanced things are almost impossible to get in that model that you described, Eric.
So who makes the decision then? And this isn't a pivot here, but who makes the decision of, do we get in-house support, some type of hybrid of the two, or do we do it all ourselves internally? And the reason for me saying that is more of a leading question. One of the more characters in Detroit, Martin Bailey, had posted something that I read, and I thought it was really interesting. I had immediately comment on it. But it was, should the CISO report directly to the board? And the article was really interesting, and I had to read through it, because at the end of the day, who is deciding whether or not this is in-house or out-of-house? And if you're making the decision as a CISO, but then you have to scale that up to the next level, the CIO, and the CIO has to take it to a board to say, hey, this is why we're doing it. And I'm not saying this happens, but there is a little bit of that lost in translation, the game of telephone. As the message is passed, how does the message change, right? And at the end of the day, is it a value proposition or is it a business risk?
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to give you the answer that you didn't want. It depends.
I'll give the more concrete. Yes, it's both of those. And I think that also, that it also engenders the next part of the discussion. And I'd say, let's leave that hanging while we do some quick intros and welcomes now that we're 20 some odd minutes into this. But with the outs on the other side of it, continue that question, but also then, what does it mean for best of breed versus suite, and suite for the sake of cost mitigation? Buying, lumping all within one vendor you already have in order to get a better negotiating position, even if it means that you're not going to get all of the features and functions that you would if you bought bespoke tools. But before that, hello, everybody. Happy July 4th. It's the 4th of July here in the U.S. Well, actually, it's the 4th of July all around the world, but it really is only a day of celebration in the U.S. Welcome. I'm Dan Ayala.
You got Eric Willey.
And Brian Schneebly.
And we have to say Brian Schneebly has been upgraded from our security friend to absolute equal partner because he now has a microphone. One of the feedback that we've heard loud and clear, or actually has been, I guess the phrase would be murky and muddy, that we've heard is that Brian's audio needed some help. Brian has now successfully navigated the delays that come with everyone on earth wanting a microphone and a webcam. And he's now got a microphone that is on par. And so we've promoted him and elevated him to equal sound partner. Welcome, Brian.
So is that security-minded friend gets upgraded to security-minded partner? Are we giving that a different term? What's that look like now?
Security-minded sounds awesome.
There you go.
And now everybody can hear my true voice coming through loud and clear. So Thank you, everyone, for having me.
Welcome to episode 4, as yet unnamed, but we will we'll put that at the head of the show. Like I said, it's July 4th here in the U.S., and we're really excited to be back again. I don't think there's any other housekeeping items. We'll put show notes for the link. We'll start with the article that Brian just referenced around that Martin Bally posted, and go from there. If you have questions or feedback, you can email us at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. You can go to the website greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. We have a number of other avenues, LinkedIn and other places, where you can come and leave feedback, share information, share thoughts and ideas. We'd love your ideas as well on future discussion topics. In fact, today's discussion was generated by listener feedback. So thank you to you for providing that information and for listening. And now, back to the debate.
We're back.
I was keeping myself muted there. It is the 4th of July, and my neighbor across the street is a helicopter pilot for the U.S. government, one of the military branches.
Does he have a helipad in the yard?
No, but he will bring this by on the 4th. He was just going, when I was pointing up right now, he just brought it by. He does a flyby over the houses, and then will hover over the water and take off. And that was just cool. Happening, and it was quite loud. I was like, wow.
There's nothing that attracts loud outside noise than the on-air light. It's just a guarantee. It's a magnet for loud noise, loud unexpected noises. But that's all right. We can edit it out in post if there was anything there.
Oh, no problem. So jumping back in though, I really liked where that conversation was going. So I feel like we should pick up where we left off there.
Yeah. Why don't you seed the question one more time, Brian?
So when we talk about the idea of who makes the decision, right, for whether it's going to be in-house, out-of-house, or a hybrid version of it, and the idea of that question, obviously, because we understand who's probably, I won't say pushing that, but in the organization, it goes up the hierarchy, and a CISO will then explain to the CIO and the CIO, possibly to a board or the president or other management, who ultimately makes that decision. And it came from reading the article when I was reading that article that Martin had put up that said, should the CISO report to the board because this is a business risk? And when you look at boards traditionally of very large companies, especially some of the largest enterprises, those boards tend to be more elderly male. And that's very true. And they looked at it as this is an IT issue or this is an IT risk, not a business risk. Reading the article, I highlighted a few things there. And one of them was that point there. When you looked at it, it was saying there's an age discrepancy. And because of the age discrepancy, it wasn't that they didn't have knowledge base of IT. It was as IT has evolved, they haven't had their hands on it over the last 10 years as much as those and some of the younger generations who have been out there watching these new security tools a develop, but also the threat actors change and develop. So kind of posted the question there and then threw some more out on top of it.
The board comment itself, I think that's evolving over time, right? As we start to see more diversity come onto boards, as well as I think the general understanding and is kind of push is that boards have to not necessarily have a security-minded friend that sits on the board, but at least somebody that's advising the board from the outside. You know, I look at it from our perspective, and usually once a year, we'll bring somebody, a reputable source on the outside, they'll provide some security knowledge, as well as we'll bring some from in-house on what we're doing, so that it creates that different perspective. But I think some of it, the reporting structure depends on the vertical you're in as well, right? If you're highly regulated, it might end up being to an audit committee somewhere there, where it's more where we've got to go through the controls. We've got to make sure those things are in place. And some of the reporting lines also depend on who holds certain roles, right? Because one of the things you mentioned, Brian, is that some things get lost in translation, and I agree with that. You know, one of the cool things in the position I'm at, so I report to our CIO, but our CIO came up through security. So nothing gets lost in translation. So I don't have to worry about that. There isn't a push to try to get outside of that. It's a great fit. Now, that doesn't exist for every organization. There are some other organizations, like you said, where you've got, I don't want to call it technology atrophy, but it necessarily, you know, a CIO's role was more about building the business, operational, uptime, and those things, where they never kind of learned all of the other aspects to security. And to your point, yes, things are lost in translation, and there you've got a fundamental problem. And whether you're building outsourced, insourced, hybrid, whatever that model looks like, you know, I come back to it, it's so nuanced and so many different variables that come into it. But the key term I would use is defensible, right? If you can make an articulate argument standing behind why you made the decision, then you should be good. I'm not saying it's 100%, but you have to put yourself in a defensible position that if you had to go on the stand, that you could 100% get behind why you made the decision and be able to explain that to the outside world.
So if security becomes, like when people say we're building an organization, so great organizations start with great foundations, and then you build up on those foundations. If the foundations are rocky, organizations can tumble. So is security then, in your opinion, one of those pillars of the foundation? And then I'm going to pivot here, because if it is one of those pillars, what type of foundation are we building on top of? Because I feel like with security changing so much, I mean, is this basically like the foundation of building an airport where you're blowing up a mountain and moving all of that soil into the ocean and building on top of it? And then every 2 years, you're shimming it a little bit so that it still stays level. And I'm not calling out any specific airport globally, but I think we know which one that is. Just saying, with security changing ever so much, yeah, you started to build a good foundation, but what you found is things rapidly change. So we're constantly having to do that shim. You know, is that part, would you say security is part of one of those pillars of the foundation of building the enterprise or business?
I think it is now. Go ahead, Eric.
No, I was going to defer to you. Go ahead, Dan.
I think now more than ever it is, as you're seeing CIOs that come out of security, as you're seeing CIOs and CISOs having business-minded discussions, the move towards security as part of the business is even, it's materially complete. Businesses that don't have security in them aren't going to last very long either, because of technology, but also because their customers are demanding that they do things with security in mind from the beginning. This now is applying more and more to privacy as well. It is a core competency as much as having an appropriately minded CFO, as much as it is having a sales force, as much as it is building good products. Security is part of that business. Whereas 5 years ago, I would have said you wouldn't necessarily win a deal because of your security posture, but you would you might lose one. You might lose a deal. I think now you can win or lose deals across just about any vertical because of what you do with security in your organization, or what you don't do with security in your organization.
Absolutely. I thinking about that too, if it's not a pillar, what's it become? It becomes bolt-on. Right. And we talked about that in a prior episode, that the cost of bolting something on after the fact is very costly. It's inefficient. And usually it misses the mark. Right. I mean, if you look at, go back to where Dan was going about a CFO, right, would you look at a tax department and say, all right, you know what, you know, we're going to spend all this money. We're going to buy all these things. We're not going to worry about the tax implications. Let's don't even run the numbers. We'll just figure it out down the line. No, you wouldn't, right? Because this, as part of that whole process, you've understood that we could make some moves that at, come the end of the year or come tax season, that could be detrimental to our company. So it's ingrained in all of the decisions you're making. And security has become, I should say, it's still becoming, not every organization is there, but it has to get to that point where it is ingrained in everything that we do. And that's why I'm a firm believer that the number one skill a CISO has to have is building relationships. Because building those relationships and understanding the different business components is what allows you to start building in security across the different silos within the organization.
Absolutely.
And kind of going on top of, again, the comments that were just made when you talk about winning business or losing business because of your security posture, I look at just taking one vertical, such as automotive, which has a very lengthy supply chain, aerospace, has a very large supply chain. And you look at the shutdown of COVID and coming out of COVID, the supply chain, not just in automotive, but even if you were doing an outdoor project right now, there's different builders that say, well, I can begin next week, but I can't get X material or this is on back order, et cetera. The same is true, such as a microphone, the case in point. This thing right here, if there was video, and back to this voice. So basically, where I was going with this was the idea that when you look at supply chain and supply chain risk, there's been more OEs that I have talked to that have said that they're adding to their supply chain risk security, right? This isn't the security group within the large organization. This is the purchasing group adding to one of the things they do. And when you look at automotive, they'll go in and spend 6 months auditing, not security, but they audit your quality, your production control systems. Are you using a Kanban system? Where do you get your raw material? Is all this stuff approved? You go through all of that, but never once when I was working there did security ever come up. And it wasn't until this last year or two with some major incidents or breaches that have happened that not only was the supply chain affected, but that affected the OE where they actually shut down the automaker, right? So you spend all this time internally as a CISO working with your CIO to make sure that security tools you put in place don't affect your own production systems, that you got to keep that machine rolling. But you never looked outside of it. There was not part of the business risk to include that. And even though the purchasing groups are doing it, it's still not being directed all the way up. Oop, just hit the microphone, that new one right there. It's still not being looked at as a business risk totality of internal. What are the risks we have? It's now we need to go immediately look at the supply chain and make sure there's no business risk to shut down our production, right? It's all about the production, keeping that thing moving forward. You know, that's where the revenue, the return on investment is. It's, and now it's being talked about or a little bit more ingrained of, you know what, there is a business risk here when it comes to security and we should look at that.
Right. No, I totally agree, right? Because if historically, if we look back, you know, security, back to talking with the CIO is tied to IT objectives, right? But having the conversations with the CFO, COO, you know, pick your vertical, pick your executive leader, having the open-ended conversation of what do you care about? What is most important to you? And then you can tie security controls, you can try security objectives back to that, you know, and bringing this full circle, those conversations, I think, have a lot to do with creating the determination on what you do with a SOC, on whether it's internal or external, right? Do you want to have a bunch of people that are focused on very technical IT response, or would you prefer your team to be further up the chain, you know, call it level two, level three, and more business focused, having conversations with the different business executives, training, and those things rather, and let somebody that can bring a ton of resources to bear to go through the minutiae of the security alerts that come out.
So how do you propose the value of that? And where I'm going with that is, if you're saying there's X resources I either need to build my SOC or we need somebody managing these tools that we bought, so we're paying for managed services, how do you justify that cost internally? And where I'm going with that though is, one, how do you justify it? But if you look at the position I'm in on my side, if even having certain security conversations and why somebody would ask me, well, why is the telemetry data important? And I try to go through and explain it, or I'm in a position where I'm talking to an enterprise that just had some type of big issue. Maybe an IR team came in, right? And I'm trying to talk to them very professionally, but part of me just wants to kind of take the gloves off and be like, are you seeing what just happened? Does everybody see what just happened? Like, the reason you bring in this tool or that tool is for visibility, is for context. Like, there's a reason why it costs more for telemetry data, and this is what you're going to get out of it. You know, do you even have the team? I'm looking at a team of two people right now managing a company that's a giant billion-dollar organization, multi-billion dollar. And the conversation, it's like you can't come off threatening because I'm the sales guy, right? It's like, is this guy threatening me into purchasing something? But to your point, it's like, there's certain organizations where I can go in and have a conversation. I see it would be beneficial to look at managed services, maybe not my own, maybe look at company X, Y, or Z, and here's why, right? And it's, thank you for that. You know, now I'm in like this uncomfortable position of like, oh man, did I just ask how old he was? You know, like, you just don't ask people that, right? It's like, did I just offer managed services to him and he doesn't want that? You know, like, that's coming from the vendor side. And internally, when you look at and make a decision of yes, managed services, no managed services, here's the cost, what's the value back? Because I could put together numbers to show why it would be important. You know, here's when you look at business risk, if you want to say that. But if I put together the business risk and say, here's what could happen, right? Here's what the cost could be for shutting down. Just going over your overall numbers, even if you were shut down for 1 day, 2 days, here's the impact to your supply chain. Here's the impact to the relationships with your customers. Here's the impact maybe if you were hit with ransomware, pay or not to pay. You know what I mean? There's all these things I go through and it's like, okay, now this vendor's trying to scare me.
Or enlighten you to better understanding risk management, and as companies that are not the largest and most mature in this, the idea of risk management isn't something that's automatically there. You don't build your company as a startup with a risk management process where you're trying to assess and understand those. I think there's a way to position it. The information you just said, Brian, that is about, it's not fear, uncertainty, and doubt, but rather that it's here are the potentials, and you don't skew, just, you know, take the GDPR example where everybody went around swinging their 4% of global turnover as the threat that would happen if you didn't do GDPR right. But when in reality, it was a much more reasonable number, and it was based on what you said before, based on being able to defend the decisions you made and say, we've done this, we made conscious decisions about this, and we took the following risks. The same thing applies here. If you go in with the 4% number and say, it's going to cost you $38 million if you don't do this, then the reaction will be visceral, and it will be, you only get a few, fear runs thin quickly. You only get a few shots at that, and people will generally have been desensitized to it. But if you go in with we think there's a range of things that could happen. This is the more likely. This is the worst case, but it's pretty unlikely. And start to set the risk management mindset. I think that's a lot better received, especially in organizations where there isn't necessarily a risk-minded person, perhaps outside the CFO, who are generally pretty risk-minded. And be able to position it that way, reasonable risks and ranges of risk and likelihood of risk in the same way that any risk manager would pose them. And I think then it opens the door to the discussion rather than closes it.
I'm going to throw out one quick example. It's not security. It's looking at long slide rail systems inside minivans. And through the whole design process and the testing of these things, it was determined that you could possibly get a Lego, maybe a Cheeto, or even a penny into one of the slots that would cause the mechanism not to work. And it was one of those that you're like, there's no way. And you looked at it a million different ways and they're like, you'd be surprised at what a child can do, right? And we test these things over and over and over again. And the determination, because it took so long to get there, and the timing to be able to kick off the drawings was, okay, we need to add all these protective, I'll call it like a guide protector, to run the entire length of it. And that person's gonna put it on at the end of the line. So you had the cost of each one of these on each side, plus the labor to put it on. I mean, you're talking millions of dollars at the end of the day for the life cycle of a five-year vehicle, millions of dollars, because there was the chance that a penny could get in there. And maybe that was cheaper than having to actually warranty and pull the entire rail system out of the vehicle along with the seats and put a new one in. And I found that interesting because you just said, you know, look at the overall risk. And yeah, here's the ones right in front of you. And then there's these that are very far out there, almost as what ifs, right? So maybe not that big of a deal. But when you look at the production side, the what ifs are, okay, we need to test those what ifs and we need to see that. And I find in the security world, it's, well, here's, like you said, here's the bucket of problems I see right in front of me. And here's the ones that, these are kind of what ifs. These are one in a million chance, but it's those
500 years flood.
Yeah. You know, it's those, what if by chance this happens, you know, and whether or not you actually have a tool to prevent it, but it should be talked about, should be known about. If this, what if happens, what is our protocol? What do we fall back on?
So I totally agree with that. And I get why some of those equations are used, but you know, I'm going to take counter to this. I think a lot of those equations for ROI on a tool and the need for a tool are often broken, because I think they're based on a greenfield approach, a greenfield view of an organization. That if you're coming in and there's no security controls in place, we know about the risk, this tool can do X, right? It can prevent against those things. But it's fairly myopic if you're going into an organization that already has tools, already has controls, because what it can't do is take into account on defense in depth. What controls are already in place that could mitigate some of that? So the risk that could be, I could breach 10,000 records or something like that. Well, maybe there's a control that's already mitigated some of that and lessened it to, well, you can only pull 100 at a time, right? So, I mean, that's kind of an overly simplified example there. But I think some of those ROI and we're going to get rid of headcount and we're going to save you this much, and whether it be actual dollars working with setting up your SOC, running your SOC, or we're going to save you this in dollars on that you won't have to pay out for a breach or all of those, I think the equations are often too simplified to matter to some of the more established companies outside of being tied to audit findings, right? If you're going through and you're tying to whether it be CIS or you're tying to whatever the other framework and there's a deficiency there, I think there that gives it more credence on where there might be an element missing from the security chain or the security armor, if you will.
And often those approaches are designed to induce fear and make you want to buy the technology, which I think is what a lot of us are reacting to when people come with that type of approach and say, it's going to be this. This is the fear. This is the level. Then you discount the entire discussion, which I think is also equally unhelpful. But they also, those assessments, those metrics also take into account the benefits of using more of a particular technology and shifting away from others, both as a method of gaining revenue, but also using the tight integration that exists amongst them and the trade-off. It doesn't really go into the trade-offs that come along with it. So I think I want to take the conversation back to the point I made earlier, or to the point I made earlier around some of the suite, the integrations that exist and the benefits that you can get of having that integration, the cost. Yeah, we're in a time of austerity now, where companies and organizations are looking for every opportunity to reduce cost. And when you have a vendor who has these as features that are addable license types that are part of a product you've already bought, and they could just be enabled, the deployment is relatively easy, but may not be 100% of the way. And in the same way, we make the discussion around inside versus outside for operating services. What about suite versus best of breed, especially when leveraged via the purchasing office.
Yeah, that's an interesting, I think oftentimes it comes down to the cost equation, right? Best of breed is synonymous with buku dollars, right? You got to have some money to pull it together, because not only do you, in most cases, have to have the money to procure each of those tools, but a lot of those tools, now this is getting better where the tools talk to each other, but then you need another tool to, that is a, you know, I think we're calling it SOAR now for the, this, I don't, what's it actually stand for?
Security operations and
automation.
Orchestration and automation.
There you go. I should have known that one, but essentially you've got to now
create. You need more sales visits.
Yes. There you go. You have to buy now another layer to put on best of breed to now make best of breed talk across the channel. There's definitely some benefits there, but I can see the draw to going back to the days of, well, I can just buy everything from one suite. They've got the illusion of a single pane of glass. It's just all encompassing. It's cheaper. But again, you know, I come back to my term, is that defensible? If you knowingly make a decision on one of the verticals, whether it be, you know, EDR within a suite, whether it be, you know, pick your other term, and you know that it is not as good as some of the other candidates out there, and that becomes the place, the fall down where you end up getting a breach that should have caught an attack, is that defensible?
Apologies. I thought maybe after this podcast, you wanted me to try to sell you another product on the 4th of July. I do have 30 minutes at the end of this.
Totally. That's awesome.
The appendix to the show will be a sales pitch.
Right.
No, it will not. Please do not turn off.
Yeah. Do not stop listening. I think when that conversation about best of breed, buku dollars, overall cost, I won't say I couldn't agree more, because I'm sitting here on the vendor side, but the conversation or the reason for not bringing somebody in, and I've heard it happen more than once, is the assumption that, you know, if somebody had this project in place, but as you were just alluding to, budgets have been reeled in since the beginning of COVID, right? And it's like, well, that project has to be cut. We just don't have the money for that. And it's before even looking at it, the assumption was already that it's going to cost me X, Y, and Z to put these other tools in place. And I don't want to go through and reference, you know, what type, whether, you know, you brought up SOAR or brought up MDR or EDR, endpoint detection and response, or a SIM. You all these different tools, and it's like, well, now I just don't have budget, without actually going back out and saying, is it really going to cost me X, Y, and Z? You know, because maybe some of these companies are actually hungrier than you thought now, because they too were worried that people's budgets are getting cut. So now it's a chance for the security companies to step up and say, really, from a cost standpoint, where are we headed? You know, like, and from a negotiation standpoint.
Well, it's you took it right where I was heading around the negotiation standpoint, because now if you look at companies that are broader, that aren't just security aggregate, that are enterprise aggregate, and the desire is to say, the more I can put into this, the better our negotiating position is to buy email, to buy file sharing, to buy all of these things. So now we come back to security as part of technology, part of the business. How do we do, you know, is making some trade-offs on security, the ability, does it enable us to do more as an enterprise? Does it enable the organization to do more and buy more? And I think it's also not as much about not buying a technology, but ejecting a technology that you've already got, because the run price might be lower, and encourage better broad scale negotiation potential if we aggregate it all into a single vendor that it's a feature for, it's a line item for, and say, now our spend is going to go up with this vendor. And this is applied. There are many of these suite vendors that have shown up over the years and have had security componentry. You know, this is the same discussion I had in 2000 related to suite versus best of breed. But I think it's happening again as you're seeing a new spate of vendors, of technology companies, making security key features in their offering. And for me, it's become a question of, is 80% good enough? You know, Eric, to your question of, you know, is it defensible? If you go in with the mindset that you are impenetrable and that any steps you didn't take caused you to be more, you know, more vulnerable, I think is one that's going to it's guaranteed to end in exactly where you think it will. Attacks happen. Compromises happen. It's how you respond. It's increasingly how you respond. That's the important part. And so the question is 80% good enough? Is 75% good enough to get us through? And can we actually now use the savings to buy three or four more security technologies or other things to help bolster our breadth of position rather than be really good in one and not have anything cross the others?
I get that. It's the age old question, is something better than nothing, right? Mm-hmm. And the opportunity to put something in there. But I feel like if we look back at the market has told us that doesn't work. It worked for a time. You know, let's call it two big ones that were entrenched giants. You had Symantec, you had McAfee. Their relevance today. Symantec has been broken apart into multiple different companies. We'll see if parts of it reinvent itself and spring back. McAfee, I think, is heading in the same direction. And those were your kind of big suites of products that they finally got to a point where we realized, hey, we're trying to be best in everything and we're not great in anything. So people have started to move back to the best of breed. But then, you know, the counterpoint to that is you've got modern day Microsoft. I'll be honest. I think Microsoft is becoming one of the best security companies out there. Some of their tools are pretty solid. But if you take, and I think they call everything ATP, and it's ATP for email. It's all of these different things. If you take any one of those components and compare it within its market, it's not best of breed by any means.
Right.
But to your point, Dan, I guess what you start to get is the sum of the parts, or the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, right? That if you can buy into the whole suite, the interactions that you get, as long as the interactions are there, that starts to become a compelling argument. But I think in the case of Microsoft, I think that the sum for a lot of companies is much more expensive than going for the couple of best of breeds that I want to shore up certain areas of the organization.
And the licensing structure in that particular one is such that it's not all that user friendly. It's not all that, it's not pro buyer.
I think you can get a doctorate in Microsoft licensing now. I think it's a thing.
It's funny you say that, because I had one person say, and this comes up, and I'm glad you guys, Dan, you jumped in there, because I didn't want to be the vendor just to jump back in after a whole Microsoft ATP conversation. But you hear the conversation, yeah, but it's easy to purchase. And I would say easy to purchase from the standpoint of you're cutting one check, but it's just a really, really big one. And they're like, well, internally, the management is all in on, when you were talking about a suite of products, right? We're very heavy, or, and this comes up with, we're a Cisco shop, we're a Palo shop, we're a Windows shop, or a Microsoft shop, right? It just makes it, when they say easier to buy, I don't think it's always easier to buy just because of the price standpoint, easier to buy because internally it's easier to explain. It's that whole suite of stuff, right? Where you can go in and say, we check the box for X, Y, and Z, and we're also going to get these three items as well, and we're covered, right?
It's another walled garden. It's, you know, it's no different than than Apple's ecosystem, than Google's Android ecosystem. It's a set of technologies within a garden that are designed to work and play decently with each other, and encourage you to stay in the garden. And you have to make your own decisions about whether or not that's good enough for your organization, or whether or not there's components you need best of breed and you're willing to spend out in order to do. And I think in my mind, the answer, there's no single answer, just like everything in life. Being on the poles on either one isn't the right answer. The only place where that works is at the races. You only want to be on the pole when your race starts today, which I'm really looking forward to watching. Very different races this weekend.
It's going to be cool. It is very much historic this weekend.
But being on the polls is not the right answer. And finding, you know, maybe you can take the suite for 80-20 within the 80-20, where 80% of your stuff will be good in the suite. And then there may be 20 or 10 or 5% of things where you have to go to the best of breed because what you need is specialized. But you have to be willing to, you know, it's a difficult discussion when you're in austerity and you say, well, I know we could do this, but we've looked at it and these pieces just aren't good enough, or they don't fit our needs. So we need to go and spend a little more, or we're not going to stop spending more just because insert suite vendor here sent you a spreadsheet that says you could save $4 million. You can't take any of it at just on its own. You have to look at it back in the back to the contextual discussion. It has to be in the context of your organization, of your needs, of your security posture, and the expectations that the people that count on that security have for the security that's being delivered.
Right. And within the skill set of your team as well.
Yeah.
Right. Eric, I think that's a key element.
I got a question for you, and I hate to get off topic, but do you ever find yourself when you say ATP also saying APT because you use the word, the acronym Advanced Persistent Threat, and then all of a sudden you're talking about Microsoft and you're like, yeah, but they have Microsoft APT, and it's like, I mean ATP.
Yeah.
Does that ever happen to you?
That's all the time, but I don't think it's just unique to that. It's our industry as a whole. I was kind of laughing as we were going through some of the buzzwords, and I was going to yell out bingo, you know, playing buzzword bingo here across the card, and I love it being in the industry, but it's gotta be confusing as all get up to those outside on how many different acronyms we have.
Well, I think it's also indicative of the difficulty it is in breaking into the field.
Right.
You know, we hear this a lot from people trying to make their first steps into security, that one, it's very opaque. We claim we need people, we want people to join, but we don't always make it easy to do so. No. And wording the lexicon is one of those, but I think it's indicative of a bigger trend where we need to be better about helping people come into the field and make it a place where people can step in and really be productive as quickly as possible. Yeah. But yes, so I too, Brian, have the same trouble.
I was going to circle back real quick to something you said much earlier, Dan. You know, I've been thinking about this. When you were talking about one of the reasons not to go with an outsourced SOC is that there's a lot of, I'll call it shade, that outsourced SOCs take that, well, you don't know my organization, right? You don't know what's going on within the business. But isn't that changing? I mean, if we look at UEBA, right? I'm starting to love this space.
And what does that mean?
User another and event acronym. Behavioral analytics.
So and what does that mean?
So from my take on it, here we go, another buzzword. It's using big data. It's using large sets of data that if I can watch activity over a long enough period of time, I can drive norms. I can drive norms for individuals. I can drive norms for people within a department, creating collections. And then you can start picking up on deviations from those norms, right?
So it's heuristics.
It's heuristics, but it's based on watching somebody long enough, right? So if I watched you long enough, Dan, I know that your habits back when we could go to work, that you know, maybe you run in the morning at this time. Maybe this is the time you go to work and you start to create a baseline, then all of a sudden we see a deviation from that. Ooh, what's Dan doing now? I mean, that's getting a little creepy privacy and me watching over your privacy drone.
Let's insert some ads here.
Yeah, there you go. But thinking about that if we start seeing the managed security providers moving to that model, is it possible then that they, using those big data sets, start to actually know more about our internal employees and what they're doing than we do as internal employees?
Sure. And we're already seeing this, and not to bring it back to Microsoft, but we're seeing this. Look at the My Analytics portion of Office 365, where it will tell you about who you're interacting with, how much time you're spending with them, how many meetings you're taking. Are you taking too many meetings? Those kinds of things. It's actually really useful insight taken just from your normal behavioral activity in Office 365. It's creepy as all get out. And it's not, you know, I personally disable it. And I think it's been implemented in a way in which it is very big brothery. But if you take that out of it and you just look at, hey, there's some analytics based on use. that tell me a little bit more about me and the things I do. There's a lot of use. And I think you parallel that into what you said. And yeah, you get a lot of insights about your organization, about what you do and how you operate and what norm looks like by seeing that kind of information. The counter, however, is how often we all know that there's things going on in our organization that we don't know about. If you do that and you don't have the context of what business should be, are you baking fraud? Are you baking existing threat actors into the norm? And now they've become further entrenched and absolutely undetectable.
Yeah,
that's a bit of it's a bit of a comment way on the pole, as I said before, but it's one to think about.
It is.
If you have somebody that doesn't care as much or that doesn't know as much about your organization, and I'll rescind the care piece, that doesn't know as much about the organization, to be able to identify those, will they just get baked in forever?
It's the same concept when you're talking about artificial intelligence, right? And creating biases and that the bias can exist within a large data set. Yeah, I totally agree. That's totally an issue. That if you come to the table, all right, I'm going to create these baselines, but you create it without cleaning house, then yes, you have a problem. The baseline you've created is of bad behavior. So I think you almost have to, it's got to be a, you have to prequel it, or you have to, before everything, make sure that your house is in order, you're in a good state before you can start creating the baseline. It'd be the same thing when we used to take, you know, you talk about a gold image of a computer, right? If you take a gold image of a computer, but you create it off of a bad build, well, you're starting from bad every time you build a new one.
Build the malware right in there.
There you go.
And I'll go back to one of the people I worked for that I respect perhaps the most of anyone I've ever worked for. He ran the service desk. This gentleman was really knowledgeable about bridging operations and giving perspective to people that may not have seen what it takes to run technology in a company. And one of his favorite phrases was, you can't outsource your mess for less. And this is one of those cases where you have to know and understand. So bringing it all back around, and we're just about out of time, bringing it all back around to in-house and out-of-house, you kind of have to know what you've got before you can send it out, or you're going to get back, you know, equal garbage to what you sent out.
100%. Yeah, totally, totally agree. From my perspective, I'm a huge fan of that hybrid. Right? That hybrid model that, if, you know, back to what you were saying, if you're in an organization, you can go all in, and I mean all in, and build a SOC and do it right. Awesome. That's awesome to be in a position to do that. But if you can only get partway, it's not going to work. You got to go to some type of hybrid model. And the way I look at it is, you know, I tell a lot of vendors out there, my team doesn't need more data. We need better data quicker. The more data thing, the monotony, the noise and all of that, I will outsource that every day of the week. I can use an MSS to weed through that. I want to be level 2. I want to be level 3. Hand it off to me, and then we'll apply that alert that comes through to the business context to determine if that is something that is credible or not.
And that could be outsourced either to a technology or to a service provider.
Correct.
And a lot of times those service providers, though, are using some type of technology that either they created themselves.
Sure.
Or they've bought into somebody else's technology and turned on an easy button that allows them to filter things a little bit better so that they can react faster for you.
Wait, there's an easy button?
I shouldn't have used that word.
I've been doing this wrong for 25 years then.
The easy button was a bad word. One thing I did want to say or leave everybody with on the 4th of July, because I think we've come a long ways in the last 3-4 months since COVID started. And I thought it was great that we all got together here on the 4th in the morning, virtually. We're all not hanging out together in the same room, but I was over at a friend's place yesterday on the lake, not inside their house, just outside. They had a little beach area.
I like how we all have to disclose that now.
Just so you know. And the first thing I tell people too is, I just want to let you know, before I come over, you know, my kids went back to daycare a week ago. Are you still comfortable with us, you know, being, you know, coming over by the beach? And yeah, you know, no one's sick, are they? No, nobody's sick. Everyone's good. You know, they do a temperature check, everybody. So there's been that, right? It's a little bit different. You see the gatherings are a little bit different, but they too were without internet. So my internet's been down and it just came back after 3 days and there's been no word about what happened, et cetera. But when I was talking with my, And I was talking with my friend's wife and she said her internet was down too. And she pulled it up and I said, do you have a guest Wi-Fi? And she said, what do you mean a guest Wi-Fi? And I was like, you know, if you ever have people, family, et cetera, over, do you allow them to access directly into your network? Or did you set up a separate network, a Wi-Fi? And this is a recent build too. So I know they have a ton of smart systems in their house as well. I go, do you have all your Alexas, your Sonos, your smart TVs, everything also on the same network? And it was getting into this conversation where when we were talking about the education and training level, there's little things that we can do just at the consumer level for friends and family when having these conversations that start to bridge the gap a little bit more and make people a little bit more aware, done in a gentle manner. And just having that conversation yesterday and then showing or explaining why it would be important. And I think it goes right into the business sense too. And I was thinking about this from my comment I made when I said, do you just go in and scare people? Right. And it's, if you can walk through that conversation in a gentle manner and explain why it's important because you were able to find a way to bring it up. And I wasn't looking for a reason to bring up why they should have several different networks in their house or why they should have a guest Wi-Fi. Being in the security world, I just assumed that I should be on their guest Wi-Fi if I was going to try. And they were like, we don't have a guest Wi-Fi. And I'm like, gotcha. And I won't ask, I won't say who they were using or what I recommended they do and et cetera, et cetera. But it was a very interesting conversation. So on this 4th of July, one thing I would ask to all our security-minded friends out there and security professionals is find a way to bridge a little bit of a gap with anybody you have the opportunity to talk with. And just like the guys from Wiser. And I, and that's where I got the, I immediately showed them the little cartoon picture and walked them through it. And it made it very easy to explain. So find the time to not scare somebody, but explain to someone the importance of maybe something simple they can do at home that helps them protect their family even more.
That's great advice.
I
think my family wishes I did that a little less with them, but yes, more people, everyone you meet, there's an opportunity to bring them along on the security journey. Thank you both. Really appreciate, it was a good discussion again today. We hope you enjoyed listening too. Again, you can reach us at Security Debate on Twitter. GreatSecurityDebate.net is the website and feedback at GreatSecurityDebate.net via email. We look forward to seeing you next time. Thanks, and have a great rest of the day, and happy 4th of July to those of you in the U.S., and happy Canada Day, a few days belated for those of you just to the north.